Welcome to Iconocast, the science and science advocacy podcast with your hosts, Dr. Greg Layden and Mike Hobrick. With the surprising election results in the United States, we wanted to explore for this episode, episode number 11, how the scientific community will be able to respond to the presidency of Donald Trump. In his statements regarding science, he has wavered between hostility to science and acceptance of science. He may even be indifferent to science, depending on the business expediency that he is analyzing at any given moment. Certainly, his positions on science are likely to be unpredictable during this term. He'll be working with a Congress that is led by conservative Republicans in both the House and the Senate. Science funding and, yes, even the concept of science being consulted for decisions on public policy is sure to take a beating for the next few years. To gain perspective on how we, as a nation, came to this juncture, we asked Sean Lawrence Otto to join us for this podcast. Sean has authored the book, The War on Science, Who's Waging It, Why It Matters, and What We Can Do About It. He's also a co-founder and director of Science Debate, an organization that has been working to elevate science's importance in political discourse during presidential elections. Sean's ability to analyze the landscape of both politics and science sheds light on how we arrived at this election result, where knowledge and power interlock and intertwine, and how we survive the bleak time ahead with hope on the horizon. Come on, millennials, you can rise up! We'll also call out the role of the media and how they have failed to deliver on their mission. We hope you enjoyed this episode, which is more political than our usual fare, but we also hope that you take heart the message and the call to action to stem the tide of anti-science politics.
Hi, Sean. This is Greg. During the election, the Republican candidate Donald Trump told us that we would all be surprised when he won in a similar way that everyone was surprised when the Brexit vote came back and Great Britain was leaving the European Union. I get the impression this is more than a reference to how the vote came out, but something deeper. Brexit was like almost like a referendum calling for Europe to move backwards a few decades in time. And I think the Trump election seems to be a referendum calling for the United States to move backwards even farther in time in a lot of social programs and so on. With respect to science, is this a referendum to move backwards by centuries?
What we have to really understand that Trump was really tapping into in some ways is that there is, thanks to science and technology, a global backlash going on. Science is shrinking the world, and we are increasingly rubbing elbows with each other. You see this a lot through the flattening of power structures across social media and the use of social media, for instance, in organizing new political campaigns, which is in fact what happened in part in Brexit and in the Trump campaign. But the bigger issue is that this is causing a rise in authoritarianism. And people who are, as in the case of Brexit, like the British Minister Michael Gove, saying that Britons have had enough of experts. And people are rejecting experts in favor of tribalism and ideology. So we see less and less credibility given to the evidence from science. And the reason that this is a problem, and the reason that I think of science as the tip of the spear, or as the canary in the coal mine, if you will, is that the whole idea of Western democracy was based on the presumption that if anyone can determine the truth of something for him or herself using the Enlightenment tools of science and reason, then no king and no pope and no wealthy lord was any more entitled to govern us than we were ourselves. And that was the self-evident argument that Jefferson really synthesized to justify modern democracy. And as we reject science and evidence, so too are we then providing an opening for authoritarians to move in and begin to dismantle the democratic system that we've built up over the last 400 years.
So in a sense, you're defining authoritarianism as something about who gets to decide what is real, who gets to decide what the truth is, and not just who gets to decide what we do.
Well, that's right, because authoritarianism is driven by the assertion of power. And, you know, you remember back at the beginning of the scientific revolution, Francis Bacon talked about how knowledge is power. And in fact, that's the case. It gives us the ability or the power to alter the physical world. And that power either confirms or challenges the vested power of corporate interests or of nation-state interests. And so we see this redistribution of power happening through technology, through the internet, through social media, through new communications forms that is empowering, ironically, as often happens, is empowering people to make their own assertions independent of the evidence.
Isn't it the case that Donald Trump gained a lot of his support through social media in exactly that way? And so as a result, we can kind of say now that almost half of the people who voted voted against their own interests, and maybe they shouldn't be allowed to do that?
I don't know about being allowed to do that, but I think it is true that a big portion of the public that voted did vote against their own interests when you consider it in this light. And this has happened throughout human history. Whenever a new technology in communications develops, be it the printing press, be it radio, or now the internet, we've seen political revolutions follow. With the printing press, the distribution of ideas through Luther's printing of the Bible and the mass distribution of the Bible, 100,000 copies, which was a huge bestseller back then, really moved authority away from the Catholic Church and split Western thinking into kind of an anti-authoritarian approach that eventually led to science and democracy that grew out of that Protestant Reformation versus the authoritarian approach that the concentrated power of the Catholic Church had been using for several centuries. And then we saw, for instance, Adolf Hitler quickly adapt a new technology of airplanes, barnstorming from city to city. He was the first national politician to do that anywhere in the world. And then later, using the new technologies of radio and the film strip to inculcate uniform ideology throughout the German population. We've seen a certain portion of that happening with the alternate reality created by right-wing talk radio and talk media through cable television after the end of the fairness doctrine in the United States. And that's only become more and more exacerbated then with the rise of the internet and social media as communications medium, allowing people to sort themselves into ideological bubbles instead of geographic affinity groups.
So in a way, you're suggesting that modern social media is going through a state of sort of chaos during which we don't expect it to work well. We just expect it to develop and evolve. And when we come out the other end, you know, is there any kind of guarantee that social media will then be a source of power for individuals and a way that that knowledge that's useful and helpful is disseminated rather than misinformation? Are we going to come out of the other end of this better off than when we went into it, or worse off? And how do we know what's going to happen?
Yeah, and that is really the key question in many ways of our time, because of course, vested interests who have a lot of money to protect and to spend on this are far ahead in the curve of using social media to spread disinformation to support their own interests. I mean, this is kind of the whole PR and advertising industry in a way, but it's being used in historically different ways right now for political purposes and to spread a certain political ideology that is really corrosive to the foundation ideas that democracy was built upon.
I think along those lines, too, it looks like the FCC chairman incoming is going to be very much against net neutrality, so that could really strengthen the position of the authoritarians in controlling the message.
Absolutely, and that's the serious problem, because that will just further concentrate power in the hands of vested interests who want to control the message, which is something that you've seen throughout history. Authoritarians usually are the first to move in and take advantage of new technology, and they do it in order to build a power base and a uniform message throughout the society that supports their agenda. And it takes considerable resistance to prevent that from happening. And oftentimes the general society is is behind the curve on that and really has not understood the dangers that are going on until it's, no, I wouldn't say too late, but until they're really behind in the effort to preserve freedom.
And so, for example, in the last election, we had thinking of two kind of groups. One is people who supported Bernie Sanders, so-called millennials, people who are just coming into the political system in larger numbers than expected for the first time. And then we also see what I more or less like I think is correct to call the silent majority, the people who ended up voting for Trump seemed to come out of nowhere with respect to the popular polls and so on. Were those two groups both energized, and did they exist in larger numbers than otherwise might have because of modern social media? Is this the first Facebook election and Twitter election?
Oh, absolutely. I think you can make a very strong case for that. The groups on both sides were highly energized, although I would say that it's fair to say that Trump didn't win the election so much as Clinton lost it, partly because I think that Clinton really didn't have as robust a social media campaign, but she also didn't have as robust of a understanding of the changing dynamics in society that this was driving, which is ironic considering John Podesta was her campaign chair, and he's very into all of this kind of thinking and understanding what's happening. But I think that the strategic error that Clinton made was sitting on the political structure and getting the superdelegates and party apparatus behind her rather than allowing an open process. And we saw a depressed vote on the Democratic side because of that. By the same token, on the Republican side, that because of the media presence that Donald Trump had, the party establishment weren't able to sit on the party structure. They tried very hard, but Trump got ahead of them using social media and using his media platform that he had already established, and they couldn't catch him. And for all the mainstream or moderate anti-authoritarian Republicans, liberal Republicans, there is such a thing as a liberal conservative, after all, for all the people that he lost in that regard, he picked up a number of authoritarians that really had not participated in the democratic process very often. And he wound up with roughly the same vote totals as Mitt Romney, despite all the moderate Republicans that he lost.
It's also interesting to note that it's been said again and again that these are two of the least popular candidates running against each other in memory. Yet the third-party candidates didn't really get any votes.
Yeah, well, but that's really the way that our system is structured, and it's very difficult for third parties to make headway there. It's also part of how the national media landscape is structured. It's very difficult to cause a conversation that is not controlled by the tight relationship between the party committees and network executives. We had some experience and things that we learned about that problem as we were working to get a presidential science debate and how difficult that was. But it's also in part the way that people tend to be wired. Our brains do tend to think of things in terms of a dichotomy, and our particular political system, which is non-parliamentary, I think favors that kind of thinking. If we had more of a parliamentary system, I think that there would be more opportunity for third-party candidates to gain a foothold because of the need to build coalitions.
Yeah, it's also just worth noting, I think this kind of fits in here, is, you know, with respect to electoral college, for the first time in a while, Americans are coming to grasp with the fact that we have a strange way. I mean, everyone always notices every year. Every 4 years, people ask about the Electoral College. They get confused by it. They wonder at it. This year, I think for the first time, where people are realizing how we've actually been lied to about it. I mean, when you go to school and you learn about civics, we're told about the Electoral College and why it's there. And you'll never hear the reason, the real reason, which is basically initially the Founding Fathers didn't trust people to vote. an argument that perhaps isn't a completely crazy argument for something like president or Senate. And more recently, the Electoral College is set up the way it is, I think, in order to avoid, with a state-by-state, the winner-take-all system, in order to avoid the problem of having a third-party candidate getting one or two or three or four electoral votes, which could throw the election out of the Electoral College completely. I mean, it's set up to avoid, it's set up to work better than it otherwise might. And
yeah,
this is an example, though, the Electoral College system is an example of, in a sense, isn't it, of authoritarian thinking? 500, initially, I don't remember what the number was, but somewhat significantly less than 538 people were supposed to be the ones that decided who the president would be, because they were the ones that were qualified to do so, because there were those rare individuals who were white male landowners and the special subset of those who were politically aware and intelligent and educated, whatever else was considered important, the small 1 or 2% or 10% of the population that was actually qualified to make this decision, those are the ones that were empowered to do this.
Right. Well, some of this goes back to the tension of the discussion between America's founders, particularly Americans, scientists, founders, people like Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin. Franklin once was asked, you know, if you succeed, what form of government will this be? And Franklin said it will be a republic if they can keep it. And this idea was the same thing that informed Jefferson's view, where he said wherever the people are well-informed, they can be trusted with their own government. But neither one of those men seemed to have much faith in the ability of the general public to be well-informed, and saw that as really the Achilles heel of democracy. So in a way, I think the idea of the Electoral College may have partially been informed by the idea that they had, which was somewhat authoritarian and somewhat elitist, saying that you needed educated voters to make these decisions, and that the people themselves, in a pure democracy, weren't educated enough to be able to make the wisest decisions, and you couldn't necessarily rely on them to do that. Therefore, they set up not just a pure democracy, but a republican democracy, where you would not vote on everything by direct vote, but you would elect representatives to make those votes. And the same thing in our voting system with the Electoral College. You wouldn't vote directly. You would vote for electors to make the votes. So the idea was to moderate or temper some of the more populist instincts that that happened in democracy and in America, and perhaps allow for some moderation. The same idea of our ability to govern ourselves was what motivated Thomas Jefferson to be in favor of the free press, so that the media would hold the powerful accountable to the people, and public education, so that the citizens themselves would have the education necessary to really be well informed in how the process works. And I think that over the last 30 to 40 years, we've seen a lot of erosion in both of those key methods of keeping the public well informed. At the same time that science and technology have exploded around us, giving us the power to affect our own lives and the world around us in ways that we've never had before. So we've got a situation of expanding power and a government system that is reliant on the well-informed voter, where people are less and less well-informed, more and more subject to disinformation campaigns because of that. A media system that has adopted the idea that instead of holding the powerful accountable to evidence, we should simply wash our hands of it and find stand-ins to argue two differing points of view and say we're being balanced and that the wise public will be well enough informed to make a good decision. And an education system that doesn't believe that there is an objective cultural truth that is based on evidence, and that the best that we can do is be guides at the side of everyone. Now, there are some advantages to all of those points of view, but when taken to an extreme like they have been, they serve to really weaken the people's ability to govern themselves successfully in a science and technological age.
Now, do you think that has really changed a lot, though? I know in your earlier book, Fool Me Twice, I think you talked about, for example, you know, Einstein's remark about people arguing about the theory of relativity. And, you know, throughout in a lot of your work, you pointed out how the average citizen has often not been that informed. And, you know, is this something that we're seeing now much worse than before, or is it something that has always been with us, but it just changes its shape and its intensity in different areas over time?
I think it's always been with us, but we're at an inflection point right now just because of the explosion of new communications technology. And as I said, in the past, whenever that's happened, it's wound up reordering society in pretty profound ways. And I think that we're seeing some of that happening right now.
I would like to see a comparison made. I would like to basically devise a test, a civics test, and give it to two groups of people to compare them. A group of relatively recent immigrants matched to the group of electors.
Oh, I'm sure that the immigrants would come far and away ahead in that regard. Well, but partly that's just, you know, that's human nature. They've been most recently exposed to it, and their level of concern is highest about it because it related to them personally in attaining a goal that they wanted to attain. Whereas the electors, you know, this is a position that they run for within their party structure, and it's somewhat honorific since the conclusion is supposedly a bygone thing. And I just don't think that they pay that much attention to it.
Right, but they're supposed to be the elite. I mean, that's what you said is true, but like this year, there are arguments being made that Donald Trump is actually not qualified. There are qualifications to be president other than, you know, everywhere it says so-and-so or such-and-such or this and that will happen to choose a president, it always mentions among the qualified candidates.
Right.
And the qualified candidates include things like not having a business empire that you will use your position as president to exploit. That's actually fairly explicit. And so he's not qualified. And electors should simply not vote for him. But they don't even know they probably have never even looked out. You know, they might be great, smart, you know, political scientists, some of them, but for the most part, yeah, they're not. They're the elite. They're the elite. They should be the elite. They should be the smartest people in the country with respect to politics and governance, and they should be at least as good as people who have passed the test to be an immigrant before they go and vote for the president as a group of 538 people.
I know a Minnesota elector, his name is Russ Ford, and he has said that basically he went in the running to be an elector just because of the fact that there weren't enough people that were volunteering to be voted in as electors. And so I think it rewards party activism more than anything else in many cases,
exactly.
In many states.
Okay, so in 4 years from now, the three of us are going to be electors, right?
Well, we should be. In Arizona, yeah. I don't know if I'd ever get a chance to vote, but you guys might.
Well, I think you guys have put your finger on one of the key issues here, and that is really the civics of this. I mean, we have a civic system that is supposed to be paramount, that people are supposed to value far and above party tribalism, and yet we are now in a situation where I don't know about you, but I certainly have no faith that electors, for instance, on the Republican side, would accept the arguments that you're putting forward, Greg, that they should exercise their civic duty and say that he doesn't meet these tests. I don't think that there will be any question raised by the vast majority of them because the party tribalism, because of our communications media in part and because of gerrymandering, has really grown more powerful than our civic affiliation.
Right. But fortunately, after the electors vote, the election has to be certified by Congress, so they'll do the right thing when it comes to them, I'm sure. But meantime, Sean, we've actually been talking politics, which is great, and you are actually a highly experienced political expert. But let's get more back to the science a little bit. You know, so what if Trump is president? How will that affect science? Is there anything specific that we have a problem with Donald Trump over in the world as far as science goes?
There are a lot of concerns. In fact, there's an argument to be made that Donald Trump is the most anti-science president ever elected. He's certainly the first president ever elected that is on record as a climate change denier. He is recently, as last week, was did a long interview with the New York Times where he said that he would keep an open mind about climate change. But then he gave us an example of, or several examples of what keeping an open mind meant. And that means that there are scientists on both sides of this, he said, who have a lot of debate about this. So he's going to keep an open mind, which essentially is saying that he's keeping a mind that is open to the arguments of disinformation instead of the arguments of evidence. So that's very concerning, especially coupled with the fact that he, some of his close transition advisors have talked about zeroing out the NASA Earth observation systems, where much of our climate research information, even globally, is driven by because of the satellites that we have up there, and focusing instead on solar system exploration to the exclusion of studying the Earth, but also his appointment of or his use of people like Myron Abel, who is one of the 12, as I call them in my book, The War on Science, he's one of the 12 apostles of denial, the architects of the global climate science communications plan that developed the public relations strategy of creating uncertainty about climate science. And this person is leading his transition for the EPA. Additionally, you know, he's made several statements that show he has a very low level of understanding of the role of science and evidence in other public policy areas, asserting that against the evidence that vaccines cause autism and that asbestos is perfectly safe and a number of other areas where he is expounded on completely anti-scientific positions. So the science community is understandably very concerned about this development and what it may mean. Additionally, he's talked about putting people like Michael Savage, the conservative radio commentator, in charge of the National Institutes of Health, saying that we need some common sense there and that he's heard terrible, terrible things about the National Institutes of Health, which has really been well regarded around the world as the leading funder of cutting edge medical research. So the prospects for science, while it is too early to see, actions speak louder than words, but based on the few actions that we've seen and the whole stack of words that we've seen so far, there's a very serious reason to be concerned.
He may also have some private business interests that are at conflict with doing good independent science as well. I only know offhand about his investment in the Dakota pipelines, which I'm not sure about. That may just be something that he has, like everybody might be invested in that. But I wonder the degree to which he has a personal conflict between his businesses and his industries and what scientists may say about certain things. I'm sure in many ways science helps his businesses, but I wonder if there's ways in which it may be interesting to see if there are specific conflict of interest that he resolves by doing a particular bad thing to a particular scientific entity at some point in the future.
Right. Well, and that idea of there are some ways that science may help his industry, that's, you know, that happens with the Koch brothers, too. You know, they're not anti-science about all science. They're very pro-geological science. But what I generally say is that anti-science is that very thing, the selective adoption of science that fits your predetermined agenda instead of accepting all of it. I mean, it just doesn't work that way. And if you really want an anti-authoritarian, democratic form of government, you got to say, I'm going to go with the evidence because that is the source of justice and civil rights because it is independent of the assertions of the wealthy or the powerful.
So what you mentioned your books. I will put links up, but you know you are the author of the very recent book, The War on Science, which I would say that your book predicted, you know, a particular election, but it certainly is prescient with respect to the kind of things that are happening as a result of this election, and you have a whole section in your book about what to do. I mean, how do you? It isn't just about the war on science. It's you know how to do it. What do we have to do as supporters of scientists, of science and scientists and supporters of scientists? You know, what should we be most concerned about happening over the next few months, and what should we do about it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, any attacks on science are attacks on the independence of knowledge and evidence, which are attacks on democracy, essentially, and attacks on all of us. And the book lays out 14 different battle plans for battling back some of these aspects of the war on science. And they're very lengthy and somewhat long to get into here, but I could kind of summarize that where they attempt to tackle are laying out battle plans for fixing the flaws in civil society that we've gotten into and for developing data and new knowledge to push back against these attacks. We need, for instance, to really empower people more to get involved in this connection between science and civil rights or science and civics. And there are various ways that we can do that. We need law clinics that are set up to really investigate the foundation of American law and remind people and promulgate policies based on the close connection between law and evidence from science and the limitations that puts on those in power. There are things that we can do, for instance, by supporting the Presidential Science Debate Initiative. This is something that we've worked on for three election cycles now, and even this cycle, we were able to get Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, Jill Stein, and Gary Johnson all to answer 20 questions about the big science issues that are facing us. And these are things in science, tech, environment, and health that affect voters' lives at least as much as the economic policy or the foreign policy or the faith and values issues that you hear candidates talking about with the media on the campaign trail. And they ought to be talking about these things as well. So the Science Debate Initiative has gotten candidates to answer these questions in writing online and made billions of media impressions over the years on this, but we have still been unable to convince a television network to go all in with us on forcing candidates to answer them on TV. And the reason that's important is not just to show their positions on these issues that affect all voters' lives, but also to show how they think. What role do they give to evidence versus ideology in their thinking? And to give the press an angle to finally start talking about that in their reporting.
Do you think this election might have gone different, because it was a close election, had there been a full debate devoted to science?
I think it certainly could have affected it. It certainly would have given a very clear focus on the big issues that young people are particularly concerned about, most notably climate change. It was really malfeasance on the part of the media that Donald Trump was not asked a single question about climate change on the campaign trail. Science debate is the only place that asked both Clinton and Trump the same question about climate change. And that really should have happened. And if there were a debate focused on not only that, but on ocean health and on the rise of antibiotic-resistant bacteria and on the opioid crisis and on mental health and on our declining water aquifers, all of those types of issues very much enervate young people. And the millennial demographic right now is larger than the baby boomer demographic was when they first really came to political power fully in 1980 and elected Ronald Reagan. But the difference between the millennial demographic and the baby boomer demographic was the baby boomers were very anti-government and very self-focused at that point in time. So the Reagan message actually, even though they'd been hippies, the Reagan message really appealed to that anti-government self-focus when he said it's not you that's the problem, government is the problem, government isn't the solution. This generation of millennials sees the world very differently because, again, of social media. They see it as much less of a self-focused experience. They see themselves much more as part of a community that is connected to each other, where fairness and justice are I wouldn't say equally important, but that are very high up there on the priority scale, along with their individual rights and individual ability to conduct their lives. So that is a potentially huge demographic change that Bernie Sanders was beginning to tap into. There's a reason this 70-year-old grumpy old socialist white guy was attracting all these young millennial voters. And it's because he was speaking that message. And I think that a science debate would have helped to focus the discussion around those issues that would have affecting those young people and would have brought them out to the polls in ways that they did not come out this time.
One of the features of millennial culture seems to be to distrust all established institutions, no matter what. And you see this a lot with people griping about the Democratic Party and the way that the primary is operated and so on. And my complaint about that has been all along that those are fine things to complain about, but when you do so, don't be stupid. In other words, don't say things like the Democrats have superdelegates and the Republicans don't, because both do. In other words, know what you're talking about a bit. But it's a legitimate question. I mean, any kind of old institution becomes ruined by itself. It becomes the agency effect takes over. The internal workings become more important than the original objective, and the founder effects happen and so on. And I think at some point it's legitimate to say we have to tear them down or throw them out or rebuild them. But within science, isn't this a problem because some of the key central scientific institutions are actually our oldest institutions, major universities, things like the NIH and other major government agencies. Societies of science, like the Royal Society of England and the AAAS in the United States, don't we have a problem that science is old-fashioned and traditional, and millennials are probably more likely to look at that aspect of science and science institutions and reject it and go for other things and therefore lead themselves down the road of, Jill Stein thinking about vaccines and other non-fact-based things?
I think that there's some potential danger in that way, but that's one reason why we bring these issues together of science, tech, health, and the environment, because we really emphasize how these are all evidence-based or evidence-driven issues, and that they are part and parcel of one thing and one approach to thinking. And because of their strong involvement in the tech world and the tech experience through social media and technology and their devices, and their fluency in the language of tech that the older generation doesn't have, I don't think that most millennials think of science as something that's necessarily stodgy. I think that they think of it in terms of the nerd culture and of tech. And that is, I think, something that we could have done a better job taking advantage of this cycle. The old institutions, there's another issue there, I think, that is always a problem, and that's kind of not just politics, but the institutionalization, the agencification, and the political thought structure that develops around science. And I think that is certainly always going to be an issue. Right now, the average age of getting your first grant, I think, is in the early 40s now, so that there's a whole cohort of millennials that are being somewhat shut out of the innovation process in research science, and are stuck in kind of a no man's land of post-grad status where they have their PhD, but they really can't find a lab job or a researcher job, and they wind up, flipping burgers at McDonald's or leading tours down the Colorado River on a raft, or drifting into the tech industry, because that is the one area where really there is upward opportunity in science and research. So there is an interesting problem that we have there that we really have to solve if we want to keep those research institutions vital. But I do think that there's another aspect of this that has to do with universities, which you mentioned. Universities really can form the fulcrum of changing this discussion back towards pro-science at a community-wide level, because particularly our land-grant universities, their role is to create knowledge that helps the local community. They're kind of the liaison between the broader world of science and then creating those jobs that we need to create right here, right now, in our local community, wherever that is. So, and those research institutions are where young people have their most recent connection with science, tech, engineering, and health, really. and the environment. So I think that there's not a huge opportunity there that we need to be cognizant of, but I don't know yet what the solution is.
Well, I think you bring up some good points there, and I want to underscore one of them, which is going back to the old institution and how, you know, things can be done in a way that is actually not, well, let me put it this way. The universities have initially were relatively elite centers of learning, and a higher education, postdoctorate education, again, relatively elite. Only the wealthy would get involved in these things. And when you got your higher degree, it wasn't necessarily to do anything with it. And this transformed over to a place where our future professors were being trained. So universities in higher education basically became factories to produce future professors who would then lead research projects with their graduate students and their postdocs running them. And the way to do that was to produce success was measured in how many people you produced and how far you distributed them across the landscape of academia and research. And that model meant that initially maybe 9 out of 10 people would get jobs, and then within about 4 or 5 years it became 8 out of 10, and then 6 out of 10, and it eventually you get to the point where you got your job as the guide on the river raft. Our universities are still pumping out people to go to jobs that they can't fill, and that is not because of an external force. It's because of the internal way the system is designed. So as a millennial looking at higher education, you'd have to be nuts to go into it. You'd have to be an idiot to not realize that this system broke about 15 or 20 years ago, and no one has done anything to fix it, and it has essentially turned its back on all the possible future scholars, the students of today who may get engaged in it. And these old guys who are still running it don't seem to have acknowledged that they've made this mistake. I mean, if, when younger people come along to me and ask about, you know, futures in academic areas, I wave them off. It's just not something that you should do if you're smart. And
do you think, you know, along with that, that and either one of you can answer this, if we have the dire situation that we are looking at with Trump and the Republican Congress that have not been favorable towards research and historically anyway, do you think that we may start losing some of our talent overseas? Like, you know how Indian students would come over for engineering and Chinese students would come over for science and research and so forth. Do you think perhaps we'll have some of the talented people that are growing up look overseas towards opportunities for getting careers in science?
Okay. Yeah, I think that's absolutely a problem. You put your finger on the immigration issue that Donald Trump really harped on in his campaign. And I know I'm in touch with people all over the world, and there are a lot of folks that are thinking, you know, should I be going to the United States now? Is that a safe place for me to go? Do I want to be studying there? Particularly since a number of universities have been built up, not only American universities, by the way, we are opening American universities on foreign soil all over the world, but a number of universities have been built up by U.S. foreign student graduates who have gone back to their country of origin and founded academic institutions there. So we're seeing a globalization of the academic world and of science and research that I don't think have really come to grips with. The United States, as the country that opened its arms to immigrants and was focusing on the values of tolerance and fighting the good fight with one hand tied behind its back, has become the country of intolerance to immigrants and wanting to build borders and reject entire classes of people based on their religion and torture people, even when the science suggests that doesn't get any useful information out of them. So we're seeing and all of which, by the way, are authoritarian solutions to problems instead of evidence-driven solutions. So we're seeing, unfortunately, the beginnings of a brain drain in the United States that I don't think we've understood will eventually further exacerbate our economic problems because even to this day, the majority of Silicon Valley companies that are successful have been started by immigrants. So we still are the beneficiaries of this wave of intellectual immigration that we are ourselves slowly eroding by our policy decisions.
In Germany, I just wanted to finish one quick thing. In Germany, they're opening up their universities and other European countries to Americans where they still have, like, free tuition as an option. So I could go to Heidelberg to finish off my degree, theoretically, without having to pay any more than just, like, room and board, or even maybe do it online. So I'm wondering about American students that Greg that came up to Greg, worried about what their future was if they went into academia in the U.S., if perhaps they're going to see that they have better opportunities in Europe, in China, in India.
Much of academia, much of the development that comes out of academia comes out of a world in which a very large number of the individuals engaged in that process are not Americans, because so many people come here to engage. And many of those people contributing to the science and the knowledge and the technology actively every single day, and then many then stay and contribute further. Others go back, they take their little American enculturation event that they went through here for 9 years and their degree, and they go to another country and, you know, spread the word. They're experts doing something in some other place, and they're part of our community, part of our large-scale community. The new changes that may happen in it's already really hard to do that with immigration law and passports and visas. It's already very hard to do that. I expect it will get not only worse, but as you point out, Sean, people will just be afraid to do it, and we're going to really have a brain drain, a kind of a weird reverse brain migration that's going to happen that's going to really affect our academia a lot.
Yeah, and that always happens in societies, again, where authoritarians take control, because it's the closing down of tolerance to people who think differently from you that causes those people to leave, and that reduces the power and the effect of the creative class, which requires the confluence of creative thinking in science, art, and engineering to survive. And at this point, we're creating a political culture that's more developed on kind of a tech school approach and on outcomes and on ideological conformity, which is corrosive to that kind of thinking.
Now, Sean, I have a quick question for you. You've mentioned the media before, and we know that there's all kinds of problems where the media could be doing a better job. How do you think the media might have – has the media learned anything during this election cycle? Has it gotten anything a bit right, or has it changed a few things in the face of criticism of being – of having too much false balance, that sort of thing? And this refers not only to the current election, but just to the last several months of activism on the part of climate change activists and other science activists, and your work with Science Debate. Has the media shown signs of improvement anywhere in recent months?
No, they've shown signs of self-reflection and self-doubt, but I haven't seen many signs of improvement. You know, when you look back on this, Donald Trump really is a creation of the media. He was given a platform based on his television celebrity that really wasn't founded on much beyond that celebrity, and yet he was taken seriously by the media because of the celebrity of his name recognition, and given, you know, $1 billion or more dollars in free advertising in the earned media that he was given. At the same time, because over the last two generations, the journalists have been taught in journalism school over and over that there is no such thing as objectivity, we have seen an erosion of the ability of journalists to think critically and to understand what their role is in a free society. And that is not to be the neutral arbiters of a playground spat, where if you find somebody with one view, say a climate scientist, then you've got to go find a stand-in to argue the other point of view, and so you can appear to be balanced in this argument or the spat, and then rely on the conflict between these two points of view to out the truth, and the wise audience, who's always smarter than you, will make the wise decision. That is an irresponsible approach, that laissez-faire approach to journalism that is based on this presumption, which is totally false, that there's no such thing as objectivity and that journalists can't be objective. I think the warning is well-intended, that you should be aware of your own biases and acknowledge them in your reporting to the extent that you can, But that doesn't mean that it's impossible for you to write an objective story, because, in fact, there science is all about developing objective knowledge. The amount of rainwater in the bucket is the same no matter whether the person sticking the ruler in is Muslim or Christian or atheist or gay or straight or any other Republican or Democrat or Green or Libertarian or any other identity group. So this idea of that there is no such thing as objectivity has hampered our media and created the idea that you referenced, Greg, of false balance.
But it's a lot easier to report an argument between a liberal and a conservative about how much water it is in the bucket than it is to walk across the yard and stick your ruler in there. I think to some extent what the media does is take the easier course.
Oh, absolutely. And they can claim that they're being neutral then, and then they don't get criticism from activists on one side or the other of the argument. But that is a cheap way out. That's dodging their responsibility, because the only reason to have a free press, the only reason to have a free press, is to inform the public by holding those in power accountable to the evidence. There is no other legitimate reason for a free press. It's not just to stand back like a wise old sage and watch the lessers argue about something. It's really to take a stand for evidence and hold those in power accountable to the evidence. And that's where we've seen the media really falling down. And this idea of false balance was taken to the extreme in some ways in the Trump campaign, where you saw Donald Trump with this torrent of lies, completely unfounded statements, demonstrably unfounded, not just about science, but things where, you know, he or others were on the tape saying the complete opposite of what he was claiming. And the media really didn't have the tools to hold him accountable to that. At the same time, you saw, for instance, Hillary Clinton making one comment, like the basket of deplorables. And because it's the one thing that she said, the media hyper-focused on that, or talking about her emails, and the media hyper-focused on that. So you have kind of, in a way, a strategy of flooding the media with false balance on the one hand, and they wind up uncritically reporting on the controversy versus the person who is not taking that approach, and you hear the constant drumbeat about the emails. What's going to sink in? Well, psychology shows it's the constant drumbeat that's going to sink in.
Yeah, with the media, in this case, the story about Trump, the story became, why can't we cover all of his lies? Instead of covering the lies, the story became, the media can't do this.
Right, and I spoke to a lot of members of the media who actually behind the scenes were saying that we're having conversations with each other about this question of false balance and how should we take some kind of stand and how should we take a stand. And I don't think that they did a good job of taking a stand. You saw editorials like the editorial boards like the New York Times coming out against Trump. That's not taking a stand. That's a paper making an endorsement. And I think that the intellectual tools in the media really are not there right now for them to be able to report based on evidence. And that's what they have to do, but they don't have the budgets for it and they don't have the training for it anymore. It's really investigative reporting, which is what they should have been doing all along.
Yeah. They can afford to have panels with 6, 7, or 8 people on there arguing over what, you know, the significance of a certain percentage point change in the polls was, but they just can't afford to send somebody out in the field.
Right, and we ran into that same exact problem with, why aren't you guys covering this climate change issue? Why aren't you covering any of these other science issues that are affecting voters' lives so profoundly? And yet they got almost no play in the media whatsoever, and certainly no play in the debates. I mean, here we had a Republican debate and a Democratic debate in the primary season within a week of the Paris Climate Accords. And we have this huge, historic international agreement, 195 countries agreeing for the first time to begin limiting carbon taxes and rebuilding the global economy in a different way off of carbon. That's an enormous, enormous agreement that's been worked on for decades. And the journalists moderating both of those debates, didn't ask a single question about it. So we've got a real failure on the part of the media that is driving a lot of this drift away from evidence. And we need to really hold a mirror up to them and demand that they do a better job of focusing on evidence and holding those in power accountable to the evidence.
Okay, Sean, in the last minute we have or so, what is it that you would suggest that people who are concerned about science, interested in science, our typical listener, what should they do over the next few weeks or months?
Most important thing I think that they can do is demand better coverage from the media. Those ombudsmen and those editors really do listen. And I'll tell you, when I go on TV, I will hear from a journalist saying, look, if we say that climate change is real, we get hundreds and hundreds of emails from people saying, why are you being biased in your reporting? Those people need to hear from you. If you care about science, they need to hear you criticizing the hell out of them when they are putting something up that is false balance or when they are not covering something like climate change that they should. They need that back pressure. They won't do it on their own. And it's coming from the other side, and that's what's really influencing the dialogue right now. So the most important thing that you can do is take the initiative to reach out, contact the ombudsmen of the networks or the newspapers, or contact the editors or the news directors and tell them your pleasure or displeasure with the reporting. The other thing they can do is go to sciencedebate.org, sign up, and at least get on the record there supporting the discussion of these issues in our political dialogue.
They also need to buy your book.
That's right. Thank you for the plug. My book, The War on Science, you can get it anywhere books are sold. You can, it's available in paperback, in ebook, and now on audiobook. And I don't know if the audiobook is available at places like Amazon yet, but it will be in the next couple of days. Otherwise, you can go to Post-Hypnotic Press, which is the audiobook publisher. Okay.
Thanks again, Sean.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Iconocast with Sean Lawrence Otto. Please refer back to iconocast.com for links to purchase and download copies of the books we have listed in this post and mentioned. Your purchases support the mission of Iconocast. Oh, and write the media to demand that science be given due respect in their coverage. That's why we make this podcast, to advocate for science.